Please take his or her seat. We'll get started. Before we turn this over to the administrative law judge, I'd like to welcome you all for attending, and chiefly for the benefit of our PCN viewers and those who are not familiar with our jurisdiction, I simply want to say by way of introduction that this is the third of our hearings focusing on current and future wholesale electricity markets. Why would this commission, which regulates only retail electricity rates and service, be holding hearings on the wholesale electricity marketplace, which is regulated exclusively by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington? Well, in the first place, 40 to 60% of customers' bills are determined by the wholesale electricity market. And that's a pass-through of those costs. We do our best to make sure that the electric companies purchase the electricity at the least cost, but this commission only regulates about 40% of the bill, primarily the distribution part of the bill. We do not allow a profit on the commodity that is passed through from the wholesale markets. So again, why should we be concerned about the wholesale market when we don't regulate it directly? Well, recently we were criticized by an internet pundit for holding these hearings. And my answer to that, and I think all of our answers to that, is that it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. Rather than sitting idly by and doing nothing and simply complaining about the wholesale markets, we've decided to hold these hearings. And we're doing so because we need to educate ourselves and understand the issues so that we can talk intelligently with the electric distribution companies that we do regulate, many of whom own generation assets that provide power to the wholesale marketplace. And secondly, we need to appropriately fashion our arguments and those given by our attorneys who advocate before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and before the federal courts. And finally, we need to advocate and have intelligent discussions with our congressmen and our two senators in Washington on wholesale electricity market issues. Those are the reasons that we're holding these hearings, even though we do not regulate the wholesale marketplace. With that introduction, I'll ask if any of my colleagues have anything additional to add. We've got a long afternoon ahead of us, an interesting one. So, Administrative Law Judge Kouchouris, will you please conduct the meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a very few introductory directions. First of all, please turn off all of your cell phones. We don't want to have those kinds of interruptions tonight. There are time limits for our speakers. I will be the person in charge of enforcing those time limits, and I have the light bar in front of me. Please don't let me get to the red light and have to cut you off in mid-sentence. I will give you a one-minute warning, and I'll try to ask you to summarize if we get too close to the end of the time. For those of you who are going to be speakers or are not already seated here at the table, we do have name tags out for you, and by the time you get here, hopefully the staff will have been Johnny on the spot and already provided those name tags so you know where you're sitting. I urge you to use the microphone. This is the voice of experience. I've done this twice before for this docket number, and we had a little rough going with me in the microphone, so get it close if you're going to be talking. Finally, we do have copies of the witness's testimony on the table, probably on the other side of that pillar over there. if by chance you want a copy and are unable to get one off the table, that they're gone already, I urge you to look at our website where the testimony is already posted, or will be posted. Already posted? It's already posted, so you can all get a copy if you don't have one now. There being no other items that I need to deal with, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, your first witness is Mr. Biden, who is the President of the Electric Generation Association. Mr. Biden.
Chairman Cawley, Vice Chairman Christie, Commissioners Pitts and Grilley, Paulson and Gardner, Judge Kacharis, good afternoon. And thank you for holding this hearing on wholesale energy markets and for inviting me to testify. At the outset, I need to correct something that appeared in the testimony that we filed with you on Monday. At the bottom of page 4, last full paragraph, second to last word, that word should read 5, not 3. Unfortunately, that's an error that we missed. In sending that to you. So I'd like to correct that right off. Also, in all likelihood, to make my time limit, I'm probably going to have to skip all of sections 3 and 5. And I've also added some introductory material that did not appear in the testimony that we sent to you. I'd like to begin by talking about the future of the generation industry in Pennsylvania. As you may know, Pennsylvania is one of the largest generating states in the United States, second only to Texas and Florida just barely edges us out. So the investment community is keenly interested in what happens here. With each passing day, industry analysts and lenders focus more and more on the political and regulatory climate in our state. Their eyes are on public policy reversals that could affect the value of their investments here. Pennsylvania no longer regulates generation, but state decisions can have a profound effect, not only on the value of investments here, but on the investment climate going forward for future generation. Even before the current credit crunch, there was an overriding need for regulatory stability in a world of uncertainty and volatility had become the norm. That's why we asked this commission to maintain its commitment to electricity competition and remain a place where promises are kept and where those who have shifted their positions based basically upon unexpected increases in fuel prices are heard with a reasoned degree of skepticism. We submit that public policy decisions should be based upon sound principles that make sense for the long run, not on fluctuating fuel prices. Wholesale markets continue to evolve and improve, and we're going to need to harness the efficiencies of those markets in addressing the many challenges ahead of us, not the least of which is climate change. Over the last 9 years, EPGA member companies have invested over $12 billion of capital improvements in existing generating plants in Pennsylvania, mostly to increase output and reduce the environmental impact of these plants. So these plants are not the same plants that we had when restructuring occurred. Generators have also spent tens of billions of dollars on fuel, wages, and taxes at these existing power plants, which employ thousands of Pennsylvanians. Our members are also planning to spend in excess of $14 billion, again, only at existing power plants for the years 2008 through 2013. Consumers have not taken any risks that accompany these expenditures. Investors have. Consumers have not paid a penny for outages, construction delays, or bad investors. Investors have taken the risks and have absorbed the losses for investments that have not panned out. Correspondingly, investors have earned the rewards that were successful. That was the promise of restructuring, and that promise is being kept, and it must continue to be kept. Turning to the issue of wholesale electricity prices, these prices clearly have been fair to consumers. And there are two simple measures that support this assertion. The first is the net revenue analysis that was reported to this commission by the PJM Market Monitor at the October hearing. That analysis showed that all of the revenues available to generators have not been sufficient to cover the cost and operation of new power plants. In fact, new peaking, mid-merit, and baseload pulverized coal plants have covered only 43%, 61%, and 71% respectively of their annualized fixed cost over the last 9 years, underscoring the need for market improvements to support new entry. In light of the Market Monitor's analysis, how can it possibly be suggested that wholesale prices have been unfairly high to consumers? While the perception is that wholesale electricity prices have been high, the hard reality is that the cost of building and operating new power plants has been even higher. From 2000 to the beginning of this year, the cost of building new power plants has risen by 130%. And the cost of the two most pivotal fuels in PJM, namely coal and natural gas, has risen by 200 and 300% respectively. And these are the two fuels that set the market clearing price in PJM over 94% of the operating hours. Paying prices that reflect these underlying costs may be difficult, but necessary to avoid reliability problems down the road. The second simple measure, showing that wholesale markets are working effectively and benefiting consumers, is the statistical evidence showing that when adjusted for fuel changes, wholesale prices have actually dropped by 23% since wholesale markets began. This evidence was presented by Andy Ott at your October meeting. Those statistics are astounding. As Mr. Ott testified, the decrease in fuel-adjusted wholesale prices shows that generators have a powerful, ongoing incentive to decrease operating costs and increase the availability of their plants, and that's exactly what we have done. The enhanced productivity serves the public interest in a number of ways, including reducing the need to build additional expensive new plants, and of course, only the most efficient will enter this market. And that is a stark contrast to monopoly rate of return regulation. Industrial customers, as you know, demanded competitive markets in the 1990s because market prices then available were below the level of regulated prices based upon embedded costs. But now that wholesale market prices have moved higher than embedded costs, the industrial customers are seeking a return to regulated embedded costs. We respectfully submit that this flip-flopping is detrimental to the broader public interest. How will we attract investment in capital-intensive power plants, which cost billions of dollars, take years to construct, and must serve customers for decades, in a policy environment in which large customers with some degree of political clout attempt to change the policy paradigm before the new plants that have already been built have even come close to recovering their fixed costs? That simply is not going to work. It was clear at the time of the utility restructuring cases that all parties, including industrial customers in the Office of Consumer Advocate, understood that a single price clearing market would be used in the wholesale markets and that the price would be heavily influenced by fuel costs. Please have your staffs check the records. Now some parties do not like the results. Why? Because fuel costs rose unexpectedly, mostly led by high natural gas prices. Now, natural gas prices have dropped dramatically wholesale electricity prices are following them down. And recent discoveries of large reserves of recoverable gas supplies in 22 shale basins in the United States, including the Marcellus Shale region in Pennsylvania, is predicted to have a long-term moderating impact on natural gas prices. The point is that policy decisions should be based upon firm principles that make sense in the long run, not on fluctuating fuel prices. Critics of competitive markets have argued that existing plants should not be compensated at the same level of new plants. You have heard this argument repeatedly. In doing so, these critics are suggesting a price discrimination scheme that they would never accept for their own products. This is just an argument for cost of service regulation. And if policymakers accept this argument, make no mistake, you're stepping out onto a slippery slope that leads inevitably back to rate of return regulation, and the risks of building and operating new power plants will once again be placed on captive ratepayers. If existing power plant owners knew that they were going to receive lower revenues based on some discriminatory vintage criteria, much of the investment in existing plants that I mentioned at the beginning of my testimony, investment that has enabled coal plants to enhance operations so that this lower cost fuel continues to set the market clearing price over 70% of the hours in PJM, would never have occurred. Assuming the climate change legislation is adopted by Congress, hundreds of billions of dollars of investment will be needed for both new and existing plants. When that day arrives, the severe adverse effects of trying to discriminate against existing plants will be painfully obvious to all stakeholders. Again, I'm going to skip the part on comparison of rates. Contrary to the claims of witnesses for ELCON and the PJM Industrial Customer Coalition, improvements in the operating efficiency of power plants have benefited consumers substantially. To the extent that baseload plants with relatively low operating costs improve availability and output, this lowers the number of hours that other plants with higher operating costs will be dispatched. The experience of nuclear plant performance illustrates this point very clearly. The percentage of time that nuclear plants operate, i.e. their capacity factor, has improved from under 70% to over 90%, with the best plants now operating more than 95% of the time. This tremendous efficiency gain, most of which occurred since the advent of wholesale competition, has been the equivalent of adding 26 new nuclear reactors nationwide without a single new nuclear plant being built. Now, Pennsylvania is number two in the production of nuclear energy. Illinois is number one. So obviously, both the PJM regional market and Pennsylvania's economy in particular benefit disproportionately from this improved operating performance at nuclear plants. And no one can say that Pennsylvania's consumers do not benefit handsomely from these developments. Coal plants have also improved their capacity factors and heat rates and reduced their operating and maintenance expenses. This greater availability of this low-cost generation reduces the need for higher-cost generation. In its effect on market prices, an increase in low-cost baseload generation is equivalent to a reduction in load. They both tend to displace the high-cost marginal generation resource. Consumers have also benefited from shifting the operational and construction risk from captive ratepayers to investors. It's important to remember.
1 minute, sir.
One?
Yes.
It's important to remember that the good old days of monopoly rate of return regulation produced massive construction cost overruns, operating inefficiencies, excess capacity, and rate increases during the 1980s and early 1990s far in excess of what is now being contemplated for Pennsylvania's utilities, even after more than 10 years of capped rates. In short, our efforts must now be focused on improving markets, not dismantling them, because as Chairman Cawley has recognized, retreat from competition is not an option. Again, EPGA thanks the Commission for holding these hearings and for providing us an opportunity to present our views. Thank you.
Perfect timing, sir.
Well, I left a lot out, but didn't want to overextend my welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, do you have questions for the witness?
I defer to my colleagues first.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chairman Christie. Okay.
Well, I guess we're going to go in the same order as we had the previous two arrangements. Mr. Biden, thank you for being here today.
And thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to meet you. I think this is the first time I've seen you face to face. And
I'd be happy to come and talk to you anytime.
I would enjoy that sometime, because we got a lot of issues to discuss here. And let me say that much of my career has been spent in the generation business. And I've been very supportive of generation in Pennsylvania. We have some of the best power plants in the world, some of the most innovative power plants in the world. We've got great professionals running these plants. And the financial stability and health of our Pennsylvania generation resources is very, very, very important to me. And let me also say that you'd be very, very hard-pressed to find anyone who has fought more for competition in the power generation sector. When I started my career here in 1985, I was responsible for implementing the Independent Power Program. And at the time, the Independent Power Program was just not looked too favorably by the incumbent generators. And in fact, I can recall one of my first meetings when I went to PJM to talk about IPPs. I literally was shown the door because I wanted to talk about competition and I wanted to talk about integrating IPPs within the big board grid framework at PJM. And it just struck me just how hostile people were to competition in 1985. And I took my hits at that time, but I knew that independent power plants would be more reliable than the traditional monopoly-owned generation. I knew they were substantially capable of having higher reliability factors, and I knew they were prepared to take the risk of developing, owning, maintaining, and operating these power plants with all the risk being shifted to the private industry. But that was not a very popular position back in 1985. But we managed to get over 2,000 megawatts of independent power plants in Pennsylvania, where all this risk was shifted to the private industry. And sure enough, as a notable example, the waste coal-fired facilities, which some of those facilities are members of your organization, they showed that you could operate a coal-fired power plant in excess of 95% availability factors. So when it comes to competition, I don't want to go back. I don't think many people want to go back to the old regulated monopoly model. That's not where I want to go. My concern is the pricing structures, the artificial pricing structures that have evolved in PJM. And I'm not sure that consumers are getting the right shake with these pricing structures. And that's where you and I might have some disagreement. Getting to your testimony, I agree with your statement on page 2 about that these markets are not perfect. So we do have something in agreement here. On page 1 of your testimony, you refer to the frequent double-digit increases. But, you know, the information that I've seen suggests that the increases prior to deregulation from 1990 to 1997 was only about 4.4%. do you have any other thoughts about where the double-digit increases were coming from?
Yeah, I'm thinking back to when I used to work in the utility industry and was regularly tasked with having to defend the frequent double-digit rate increases. I think there was a time from the in the 1980s where some of the utility rate increases were on the order of 100% over a 6 or 7 year period in Pennsylvania. So when we had some of the larger nuclear plants going into rate base and we had 40+% reserve margins in Pennsylvania, I don't know if you recall that or not, but I recall it vividly because I was in the position as an economist for the Pennsylvania Electric Association at the time trying to defend those things. But we had frequent double-digit rate increases going from the late 70s to the early 1990s. Now, the period that you mentioned was 1990 to
97.
To 97. Towards the middle part of the 1990s, those increases started to ameliorate somewhat because most of the big increases had already taken place, and the increases from thereafter were being heaped upon an already high number.
Okay. One of your arguments that you make that the wholesale power market is infinitely fair is the suggestion that you're not recovering enough of the capacity cost to cover the building of a new power plant. And where I disagree with that is we are paying stranded costs for those assets in Pennsylvania. We're still paying stranded costs for those assets. And so why is it fair that the generators should get anything more than their running costs associated with their power plants? It just seems to me that to suggest that the generators should be paid the cost of a brand new power plant when we've already paid for that power plant once, and to suggest that a fair market would mean that they're entitled to the cost of a brand new power plant just seems to me be a double dipping type of issue.
It's a commodity market. We made that decision, and the decision is that we're in a replacement cost world now, and many of those assets have changed hands, not just going into the generation affiliate of the utility, but changed hands completely with an unaffiliate entity. So they changed hands at market rates. So to be talking about running rates versus the rates that these plants are being compensated at now is irrelevant. Also, don't forget that the retirement rate of some of these older plants was getting to an alarming rate. Plants were retiring, I think it was 3 or 4 years in a row, far in excess of what new generation build was. And we already saw violations of the NERC reliability criteria. PJM was forecasting alarmingly more violations of those reliability criteria. So something had to be done. Now, it sounds to me, in spite of your prior endorsement of competitive markets, that you want to go back to compensating these plants, even though we're in a replacement value market, that you want to go back to some cost of service principle. I don't see any way to get there without in some way going back to a regime where we place the risk back on the customer.
We have some work to do to perfect the pricing model, but what I will say is that when you have 150,000 megawatts in the PJM system that basically were already paid for, and since then when we need to add new generation, And let's just say that we add a new nuclear coal-fired power plant as a high-range example. Why should all of the existing 150 megawatts that already been paid once get the reimbursed for the cost of another nuclear power plant? It's just we're trying to create this market overnight where you have all this old legacy plants that have already been paid for, that consumers are expecting to get the running costs associated with these plants. And then to compensate these legacy plants based upon the cost of new generation in order to create a market,
but
just seems to give the consumers an unfair shake here.
I don't see it as being unfair at all. And as I stated at the outset, although we moved the numbers up in the testimony because we thought they were that important, these are not the same plants that existed at the time of restructuring. And I want to also point out that the $12 billion that we've invested in those plants was by no means complete. I was unable to get complete numbers from my members. That was an impartial accounting of the billions of dollars that have been invested in these plants. And with the tremendous environmental challenges that we see going forward, and it's not just climate change. We're in the Northeast Ozone Transport Region that that is changing the environmental requirements that we face all the time. There's something that I'm sure you've never heard of called high electricity demand days, where they want us to reduce our emissions on those very days when demand is at its maximum. It could be monstrously expensive. We face water quality changes. There's a decision before the Supreme, a case before the Supreme Court right now that could cost hundreds of millions, perhaps as much as $1 billion at existing plants. Now, where are they going to get those revenues from? And if a substantial amount of that existing capacity goes away, think about the implications for the plants that are going to start setting the market clearing price. This is not a bad deal for consumers that we're getting that revenue and keeping those plants running. It's saving consumers money.
I don't.
It's not a raw deal for them.
I don't disagree that you have continuing compliance costs that represent a severe challenge and a funding requirement. But let me give you one example of how that challenge that you have is going to translate into much higher prices for consumers. As an example, if we do a carbon cap and trade program, undoubtedly the coal-fired power plants are going to have higher costs associated with meeting the carbon requirements. And so when they bid, they're going to bid into PJM under the single market clearing price, the cost of carbon compliance. But what will happen under the single market clearing price is all the nuclear facilities, which are carbon-free, will end up getting the carbon-related adder onto the single market clearing price.
Yes.
And to me, that just doesn't represent a fair system.
Well, I remember when a certain company decided to put most of their marbles into that nuclear basket, and everyone questioned the wisdom of that investment decision. You know, it wasn't that long after the Three Mile Island incident. It turns out it was a prudent decision. Should we penalize them for making prudent investment decisions? And right now, a lot of companies, including the company that I'm thinking about, are making decisions to upgrade that investment at their risk. Do we want to penalize that sort of those sorts of investment decisions by now changing the rules and denying them that market clearing price and the proceeds therefrom? I mean, this is the way the market works. This is the market that all organized wholesale markets have adopted. And every economist, certainly economists far smarter than me, have come to the conclusion that this minimizes the total cost to the consumer, not just in the short run, but in the long run as the whole system expands.
We could probably argue all day long, but I'll just submit that when I look at the data on the cost of the RTOs versus the non-RTOs and the change there are the increases that are occurring in the RTOs compared to the non-RTOs. I think it proves my point that the prices are going in the wrong direction in the RTOs because of issues like we're talking about here. But you and I will have to get into a room, I think, sometime and close the door, take off the ties, and go at it.
As long as there's no gloves in that room.
A couple more questions. I don't want to monopolize all the time here. On page 4, you reference an unanticipated run-up in natural gas prices. I just don't know how we look at it as being unanticipated. When you look at the substantial amount of new gas-fired generation that has been added to the grid, I think about 9,000 megawatts, and to put that into terms that maybe we all can get our hands around, we used the amount of gas that would heat about 250,000 homes in 1996. Today, we use an amount of gas that is associated with about 1.4 million homes. So with that tremendous increase in natural gas consumption, I think it's only logical that natural gas prices would run up. And on the single market clearing price, where gas is setting the margin now in Pennsylvania 25% of the time, when we have 90% of our generation from coal and nuke, again, I think that produces a distorted result for the consumers in Pennsylvania. I agree with you, Mr. Biden, that we've got increased efficiency from the power plants. But what I'm not so convinced, I've looked at some studies that were done by CMU, and they came to the conclusion that, yes, there have been productivity gains in power plants, but the productivity gains do not appear to be flowing back to the consumers. That's the conclusion that CMU has made in their studies. I understand the power plants are much more efficient now, but I'm not so sure that the results of those efficiencies are flowing back to consumers now because of issues like the single market clearing price.
Okay. Want me to respond?
Sure.
Regarding the unanticipated part of your comment, as late as the beginning of this decade, the National Petroleum Council, which counsels the President of the United States on energy matters, was saying with no qualifications that the price of natural gas would not rise above $3 per million cubic feet for the foreseeable future. And we were already well into the major expansion of natural gas-fired power plants by that time. So it wasn't just the generation industry that didn't see this coming. It was people who should have and were in the best position to know better. And it wasn't until after the fact that the steel was in the ground and the plants were operating that the prices started to go up with a vengeance. So that's what I meant when I used the term unforeseeable. It was at that time, that critical time. Now, as far as the benefits to the consumer, I thought that I was being needlessly repetitious in my comments in trying to spell out exactly how this benefits the consumer in terms of increased productivity, increased output at baseload power plants. I went to great pains to explain how it was at our nuclear plants. When you have the equivalent of 26 new nuclear reactors that otherwise would not have been there with the increased efficiency at nuclear plants, and how that displaces the marginal generating unit, how can that not benefit consumers? It's only because there is this bias against the market clearing price to begin with that people refuse to see that benefit. If you have a predetermined notion in your mind that you don't like the single price clearing market, you won't see that benefit when it's painfully obvious. It has to reduce prices. And that is where the consumer benefits. Sure, do generators benefit from that too? Because their plants are operating, their bids are being accepted more often and for longer duration, which is what we all strive for? Sure. And are you benefiting from the fact that a higher bid is being accepted, that thereby increases your profits? Yes, but that's what makes this whole world go around. And that was what everyone expected of us when we decided to inject more competition into markets and make us more efficient than monopoly rate of return regulation to begin with. We are doing exactly what was expected of us, and we're doing it extremely well.
Most of your plants associated with your membership, is it a fair statement to say that those plants are here today because they had the regulatory compact of the certainty of getting cost recovery, or had the long-term contracts that allowed them to be built and financed?
Most of the plants in the state of Pennsylvania.
And as far as your membership, I think most of your plants had that benefit of a long-term pricing commitment in order to help them get financed the capital cost of their power plant.
Well, they were built under, most of the plants in the state were built under the rate of return regulation error. I would say probably about 9 or 10,000 megawatts, maybe a little bit more. If you count the waste coal facilities that you mentioned earlier, maybe about 11,000 megawatts were built under competitive conditions.
Yeah. And here's my concern. I'd like to see more of those plants start to get built. I think we've done all we can with RPM as far as reactivating the old plants, upgrading plants. But at some point here, we're going to need to add new power generation resources in this state. And unless there's an opportunity, in my opinion, that there's some type of long-term contract or some kind of regulatory pact to allow these plants to get financed, I'm afraid they won't get done. As an example, how are we going to get a nuclear power plant financed if there's uncertainty as to the pricing of power? I think it's a real challenge. I don't know if you have any comments about this.
My view relative to nuclear, first of all, you know that nuclear plants cost a lot of money. You know they take a long time to build. The greatest impediment to building a new nuclear power plant right now is any would-be investor doesn't know whether or not we're going to have a fully functioning market 10 years from now. So the regulatory and political uncertainty is the largest remaining impediment to that. As far as the long-term contract issue is concerned, as I mentioned, the all-in revenues from, and let's take the PJM market because I personally happen to think that it's the highest functioning of the RTOs in the United States. If you can't get one built there, or in a market like ERCOT, you're probably not going to get one built. But that's where we are today. Investors do not have the confidence that state legislatures are going to maintain that commitment to markets. And until we see some certainty there, you're not going to see that iron put in the ground. Because, again, it takes so long to build it. And by the time you turn that first shovel, until that 4 or 5 year period passes when that plant finally starts generating megawatt hours, everything may have changed. Mm-hmm. And a long-term contract, understand, that long-term contract is going to have to replace that missing money that has been missing from the market revenues right now. So there's no reason to expect, particularly in a market where we don't know what fuel prices are going to be 6 months from now, let alone 6 years from now. So there's no reason to expect that long-term contract is necessarily going to produce any better deal for the consumer than the market constructs that we have today.
Well, I can tell you firsthand, I've been involved in the development and financing of both a project under a long-term contract, and I've been involved in the financing of a merchant power plant. And I can tell you the difference between those two types of approaches is night and day. With a long-term contract, you know where your pricing is. You go to the bank. You get your money. It's the lowest cost way of accessing the capital markets. And that can translate into a lower price offer. With a merchant power plant, the challenges of getting debt in the first place are enormous. And then when you do find the debt, the cost of that debt is extraordinary. I experienced it both ways. And so from my perspective, the more certainty one can provide to the generation market, the more they can go out and get lower cost capital, which means lower cost power supply to consumers. And I'm just afraid with the market design that we have right now that the certainty isn't there, the price certainty isn't there, the opportunity to get a long-term contract isn't there. And I'm afraid that just translates into risk, higher cost financing, and higher cost power to consumers at the end of the day. So somehow I'd like to see some certainty be brought to the equation to allow the cheaper assets to be built. I could go on forever, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
Commissioner Paulson.
Thank you, Judge. Doug, thank you for taking the time out of your schedule. I will be very brief in asking one question, but I'm going to set the question up for you. We have, as a commission, have been having an extremely productive dialogue with our Department of Environmental Protection, trying to align what we do here with the environmental side of the equation. And one of the things that was thrown out in one of our en banc hearings was the Pennsylvania marketplace is alive and well when you factor in that we've done our 97, we passed the Electric Competition Act. 2004, we've passed the AEPS requirements. In 2008, the state Senate, the governor, the House coalesced behind a $650 million alternative fuels / energy fund initiative. And then with the recent passage of Act 129 here, setting up demand response conservation targets, I think it's fair to say we've got a good market structure in place, and I want to also commend my colleagues. We've been rated as an agency by S&P 500 as one in the top 10 percentile as regulatory bodies for helping an industry access capital markets. So with that in mind, your thoughts on where do you see electric competition in Pennsylvania after rate caps come off?
After the rate caps come off, I certainly see retail suppliers coming back. Having spoken to a number of them, they're eyeing Pennsylvania as a big opportunity. We see the curtailment service providers, those folks who provide a lot of the conservation services. Of course, they like not just the organized markets, but they particularly like the states that have retail competition because it makes them easier to ply their wares and make money. I'm talking about companies like Itron, Converge, Enernoc, companies like that. It's notable that they not only support and flock to the organized markets, they're very, very strong supporters of them. So I see very positive things for the state. We have to realize that we've derived tremendous benefits from, consumers have derived tremendous benefits from the rate caps, but the rate caps are not costless. You know, they do deter investment in needed utility distribution infrastructure. They are a deterrent to investment in generating capacity, energy efficiency technology. They are an explicit deterrent to conservation. You know, people who have lived under cost cap rates for such a long period of time are going to consume more energy, and no one should be surprised that energy conservation is suboptimal, that it's less than we would like it to be. So I think I see mostly positive things for Pennsylvania's energy market, even though it's going to be a difficult transition for consumers, and I think, you know, politically it's going to be difficult for a time. But we have to remember, we've gone through periods where rates went up more than this. It's just that it wasn't in one fell swoop like this. But as this commission has done, many of the things that you've done with the rate phase-ins and so forth, you know, your emphasis on consumer education, your emphasis on the low-income programs have been the right thing, the right response. I hope that answers your question.
It does. I appreciate that. And thank you for your time. Also, thank you for taking off our hands, former Commissioner Terry Fitzpatrick, who I see in the audience. I should quote here that one, and Mr. Chairman, again, I said one question. I'm just going to, one more. I want to quote our governor. He says, extending rate caps would not be the best result for the Commonwealth, making it difficult to attract new electric generating capacity and rising the cost of electricity long term. I assume you agree with that statement.
I do agree with that statement. Yes.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Pitsengrilli.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Doug, for your testimony and your reply comments on the previous hearing. Just a couple questions for you. On page 9, you didn't get an opportunity to talk about whether you felt the comparison that we've heard from some industrial consumers regarding retail prices in other states is a fair comparison or not. Could you expand a little bit on your comments?
Well, they based that on a snapshot comparison between two Allegheny Power affiliates, one in Maryland and one in West Virginia. And there were a number of things present there that really did not make for a fair or balanced comparison. Not the least of which was due to the fact that in the Maryland, the Potomac Edison Maryland affiliate, there was the presence of a rather high-priced PURPA contract there, and West Virginia had no PURPA contracts. A lot of the costs related to labor, land, environmental control costs, for example, Maryland is in the Northeast Ozone Transport Region. You know, they had the Healthy Air Act. They're subject to much more stringent environmental costs in Maryland than they are in West Virginia. West Virginia has one of the highest percentages of low-cost coal-fired generation, much higher than Maryland. And, of course, there's a pending fuel and purchase power rate increase in West Virginia that was not mentioned, that I'm not sure exactly I had in my testimony, that it's likely to raise rates in West Virginia close to 30%. Now, there has been a subsequent settlement since we sent in our testimony that makes it look like that's going to be more in the neighborhood of 20 to 23%. But there are just so many factors that you need to account for when you're doing rate comparisons. Also, the American Public Power Association gave you numbers that purported to say that rates in restructured states go up more than in non-restructured states. Well, they included Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Virginia among the regulated states because we had price caps on. Now, that seemed particularly unfair to us. If you took those three states out and didn't count them at all, the results of their analysis swung in favor of the restructured states. So, but the biggest thing you need to look at when you're doing these kinds of comparison is the fuel cost. Most of the states that restructured did so because they had higher rates because they have an unfavorable fuel supply mix. So when you have an inflation of fuel costs, naturally their costs are going to go up more than states that have a favorable fuel mix, i.e. a lot of coal and nuclear. So you need to be very careful when you do these things. And we saw no evidence, and we've seen no evidence in any of these comparative cost studies put forward by the critics of competitive markets that they've even attempted to account for these things.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit on page 8? You mentioned the fact that EPGA members have invested more than $12 billion in existing plants in Pennsylvania over about a 10-year period, and the current plans call for capital expenditures at existing plants totaling more than $14 billion between now and 2013. Could you expand and give us a little bit, some examples of some of those investments?
Yes. Well, the existing plants, a lot of that was in environmental controls. We've had at least four rounds of nitrogen oxide controls, two of those imposed by the Northeast Ozone Transport Region. A lot of that was up rates at existing plants, some nuclear, some fossil, turbine upgrades, things of that nature. On the future capital expenditures, again, a lot of uprates at existing plants and future environmental. There are at least five large scrubber projects, selective catalytic reduction technology to control NOx emissions. We've made a lot of investments to comply with the Clean Air Interstate Rule, which, of course, was vacated by a federal court, although they're leaving Phase 1 intact. Now, if that rule is, in fact, that vacature is upheld, we fully expect it to be replaced by something even more stringent. So those investments will not be stranded. You know, they're going to be necessary eventually. But and of course, a lot of the investments 2008 going forward are for the Pennsylvania mercury regulation as well.
What kind of regulatory certainty do you need from the federal level and the state level when you talked about ensuring that these investments and expenditures are realized?
Well, I'm thinking mostly in terms of the General Assembly, which of course has been addressing energy policy issues now for the better part of 2 years. And we've seen so many things introduced, talking about getting the utilities back into the generation business, talking about a Pennsylvania Energy Authority, talking about any number of things that could cause generation investment to dry up. When we have a situation like we had in PJM where investors in new generation have still not come close to recovering their, you know, the cost of you know, the fixed cost of new plants, anything that looks to them like states are beginning to try to dismantle or decouple from the wholesale market, you know, in ways that threaten the value of that investment, it's going to have a material impact on people's willingness to invest in future generation supply. And, of course, Pennsylvania has always, over the years, been viewed as a good place to invest in generation relative particularly to surrounding states. But now that we're part of a much, much larger expanded PJM market, I think we need to be more mindful of that, because with the transmission system expanding, there's greater freedom to locate plants in other areas like West Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, places like that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Biden, for coming in and providing your testimony. In the spirit of the season, I have no questions or comments other than to say that your interpretation of the same data that I look at is opposites. I am a regulator. I'm interested in protecting consumers from price gouging, and I have major concerns on what's going on in the wholesale market. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to reserve my questions for the panel, and I would ask Mr. Biden to stay
even though he is not a part of the next group. Would you please stay? And after the next three speakers are finished, I'd like to ask all of you the same questions.
Before we leave, Mr. Biden, sir, I would ask you to stay a few moments for the break. I noticed our court reporter had written down a couple question marks about some terminology that you used. I want to make sure he gets the transcript accurately recorded. Commissioners, it's my understanding that the next three people are going to testify and present testimony to you in a panel format. So it would be my pleasure to introduce Mr. Massey, Mr. Elsie, and Ms. Beeler. They each have agreed to slightly shorter presentations, and if you'd be kind enough, I understand your format is to wait until they've all finished before you start asking questions. That being said, Mr. Massey, here representing the Compete Coalition, welcome aboard, sir.
Thank you, Judge. Can you remind me how much time I have?
Yes, sir. You have 10 minutes.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, Commissioners, Your Honor, thank you so much for this opportunity to be with you today. You may know that I was a commissioner at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for over 10 years, from 1993 until 2003. I was actually, Mr. Chairman, I was actually chairman of the agency for 3 days. It was one heck of a weekend, I'll say that. But I enjoyed my time at FERC, and it was during a lot of this movement to competitive electricity markets. I'm now counsel to Compete. I'm with Covington and Burling Law Firm in Washington, D.C. Compete now has 278 members. Actually, since I prepared my testimony, we've added 6 new members. these members have organized around the principle that competitive electricity markets are good for our nation and good for consumers. We have many, many customer members of our coalition. We and 2 of them are here today to speak to you. The demand response providers that Doug Biden mentioned, Itron, Converge, ECS, Internoc are all members of our coalition. And we have wind companies. The American Wind Energy Association is a member of our coalition. Utilities, generation companies, who believe that the markets are working well. They can continue to be fine-tuned. They are providing significant benefits. Now, our nation, I want to provide a little broader context, if I might. Our nation faces 4 really tough challenges moving forward. And the Compete Coalition believes that competitive electricity markets can play a role in meeting each of these challenges. Number 1, we have a huge infrastructure investment that's going to be required. The Brattle Group estimates it at about $1.5 trillion over the next 20-something years. And if you add in the cost of carbon reduction, it rises to $2 trillion. That is massive. How are we going to make this investment? Now, our nation has faced this before. And I would like to commend to you a brand new study by the Northbridge Group, a consulting firm. And it's called Embrace Electricity Competition, or it's Deja Vu All Over Again. And they analyze a time in the history of this nation a few years back when we were facing some of the same challenges, the need for what appeared to be a large infrastructure build-out, environmental challenges. It was done under monopoly regulation. And the study points out that there were huge inefficiencies. Consumers did not benefit from that. We ended up with very large reserve margins. And the purpose of their study, what the conclusion they come to is, look, let's not make that mistake again. Let's not have this misty-eyed reverence for regulation. The best way to do this infrastructure build-out is in well-structured competitive markets where you have locational price signals, where the risk is primarily on the investors rather than the consumers. So that's number 1. a huge infrastructure build-out. Number two, and Vice Chairman Christie mentioned cap-and-trade legislation, the cost of carbon controls. Now, the Compete Coalition believes that it's not lost on us that the cap-and-trade system that Congress is moving toward is a market-based system. Congress wants to harness the power of the market to allocate carbon emissions, and we think that will fit very, very well over well-structured competitive electricity markets that are attracting disproportionately renewable generation. Over 70% of the wind generation in this country is locating in the RTO markets, when based on wind capacity, you would expect it to be about 44%. So we're attracting renewables. We're attracting efficiency investment. Demand response is is increasing dramatically in the organized competitive markets. And Commissioner Wellinghoff at FERC has pointed out that demand response seems to be increasing more rapidly in the organized markets than outside. And that makes some sense because you have the demand, you have the price signals. So we're getting renewables, we're getting conservation and demand resources, and we're getting efficiencies. We want investments to be made in a carbon-constrained world in the most efficient way, taking into account the price of carbon. So that's number two. How are we going to meet our carbon challenge? Competitive markets can play a key role. Number three, how are we going to maintain our global competitiveness as a nation? We need innovation, and we need cost containment. And competitive markets, despite some of the conventional wisdom, are actually driving prices down because suppliers are competing. If you don't submit a bid that's in the money, you don't get dispatched. So actually, the single clearing price model, if I might point out, has a fairly significant bidding discipline to it. It actually encourages generators to bid at or close to their marginal cost. So we're getting more with less, as Doug pointed out. We're squeezing more out of more limited resources, which we need to do to maintain competitiveness as well. And finally, we're getting a lot of innovation in the organized markets. And the other two witnesses will speak about that. But there's a new lithium titanium battery emplacement in the PJM market to provide reliability services. There's flywheel generation services that are coming online. There are new products and services. That innovation is going to serve us well moving forward. And fourth, we have to reduce our dependence on foreign energy sources. How are competitive markets going to help us? Well, they are attracting renewables. They are attracting demand resources and conservation and efficiency. These are intrinsically domestic resources. And I've heard PJM speak about the advent of the plug-in hybrid and how its system is very well suited for the ultimate electrification of the transportation sector, which allows us to substitute foreign oil, substitute domestic resources for foreign oil, ultimately. So competitive markets can help us meet all four of these challenges. Now, before I close, I want to talk about two or three other topics. Judge, can you remind me how much time I have remaining?
You have 2.5 minutes right now.
2.5 minutes. All right. First of all, let me say that electricity markets have been bipartisan in nature. I came to the commission in 1993. I was a Clinton appointee, appointed by him twice. A lot of the movement to competitive markets at FERC occurred on when Bill Clinton was president, and he appointed all of the commissioners. Democrats supported it. Republicans supported it. These debates have never been partisan, in my recollection. They're more regional than partisan. So I wanted to point that out to this distinguished body. FERC recently concluded an 18-month proceeding on the RTO markets. There were about 100 interveners that spoke. There were alternative proposals that were laid on the table. There were thousands of pages of testimony that were submitted. Fairly significant changes to the markets were proposed, but the commission looked at all the evidence and decided to fine-tune the market structure in four particular areas, which you're probably very familiar with. But instead of wholesale changes, dramatic changes, they didn't want to create that kind of uncertainty in the marketplace which would deter investment.
1 minute, sir.
And they decided for fine-tuning measures after an 18-month proceeding. I'd like to remind you of customer support for the markets. You may be aware that a number of large customers wrote Governor Rendell in October to talk about the value of the PJM markets, and you have two customers here as well. So let me leave you with this, and I echo what Doug Biden said. I mean, fine-tuning the market structure is one thing. Dramatic changes would create a lot of uncertainty in the market, in a market structure that is working well. FERC has concluded that it is working well, hearing many, many witnesses. So I would urge you to retain markets in Pennsylvania. Don't simply take a snapshot of what you may think is going on. Markets will endure for years and provide significant benefits and help our nation meet its challenges moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Our next speaker will be Mr. Steve Elsey, the Director of Energy Services for Leggett and Platt Incorporated.
Thank you, Judge. I want to thank the Commission for the opportunity to share our perspective of the competitive electric markets. Again, my name is Steve Elsey. I'm the Director of Energy Services for Leggett and Platt. I began my career with an investor-owned dual-fuel utility in Illinois. In the pre-Three Mile Island era, I spent 22 years working for investor-owned utilities in Illinois, Kentucky, and Ohio. The focus of my career was in marketing and customer services, and I've personally conducted hundreds of energy efficiency audits for residential, business, institutional, and industrial customers. Before I left the utility industry in 2000, I managed residential and commercial programs for American Electric Power, AEP. Later, I owned an energy management company that focused on a demand response solution, and I consulted with municipal utilities and municipal electric utilities in Ohio before I joined Leggett 2 years ago. Now, Leggett and Platt is a diversified manufacturer that conceives, designs, and produces a broad variety of engineered components and products that can be found in virtually every home, office, retail store, and automobile. Leggett serves a broad suite of customers that comprises a who's who of manufacturers and retailers here in the United States. In our 125-year history, our company has grown into 21 business units in more than 250 facilities located in 20 countries. 75% of our facilities are located here in the United States, and we actually operate two production facilities here in Pennsylvania, one in Berwick and one in Wilkes-Barre. As you can imagine, our production facilities and their respective hours of operation are very diverse. We have small assembly plants that operate one or two shifts a day, 5 days a week, to large 24/7 integrated production facilities where feedstock is turned into finished components. As a large power user, Leggett believes that competitive energy markets are important. Competitive markets produce price transparency that provides end-use consumers more choices than those from the vertically integrated energy delivery construct. Competitive markets not only provide consumers the options that can mitigate price volatility, but those markets also inherently improve reliability through regional transmission organizations on the supply side and increase efficiency and technology options on the demand side. You've heard testimony in previous hearings that are contrary to these statements, but I will take the next several minutes to explain our perspective. First, let me say that I understand the positions of Alcoa, Elcon, PJM, ICC et al. These folks represent a class of customers of which Leggett is a part, but we take exception to their opinions regarding the direction of organized electricity markets. Prior to wholesale and retail restructuring in the days of the regulatory compact between the utility and consumer, cross-subsidization between billing determinants and even between rate classes served multiple purposes. Often, however, that cross-subsidization had unintended consequences. For example, demand costs that were much lower than the cost to serve that marginal capacity reduced investments in technologies that specifically mitigated peak demand. The unintended consequence was lower utility system load factors, higher capital costs to meet peak demands in the electric supply chain infrastructure. In the best case, those costs became embedded in those kilowatt hours aggregated within the time of use rate blocks that were typically spread around an entire season. In the worst case, every kilowatt hour, regardless of time of use or seasonality, subsidized the marginal cost of new kW added to the system peak. This cross-subsidization created a need by utilities to establish energy efficiency rebates to promote behind-the-meter installations of technologies whose installed costs could not be supported by the average cost, let alone below-average cost, price signals of subsidized tariffs, thus compounding the problem of cross-subsidization. In my days at AEP, before the emergence of organized markets, I found it curious that certain customers and customer classes, namely industrial customers, were among the most active participants lobbying for restructuring. They were experiencing rate increases never seen before, but the fact of the matter was that many high-use, high-load-factor customers were paying slightly above system lambda and well below the cost to serve. I couldn't imagine that in a deregulated environment they could get a better deal. As you know, competitive markets do not support the cross-subsidization between rate classes, between customer classes. The so-called average cost to serve industrial customers is actually below average cost, so it is natural that a pre-restructuring subsidized group will experience increases upon the introduction of competition. This doesn't make the markets dysfunctional, as has been suggested by some, but it proves that the price unbundling in a competitive, organized market works. I said earlier that I understand the positions of Alcoa, Elcon, PJM, ICC et al. They are coming to the realization that subsidized electricity costs south of 3 cents that they've been paying won't be in the cards in a competitive market. I'll use two examples from my personal experience. First, when I began to consult with a 100-megawatt municipal utility in Ohio, I reviewed their wholesale contract that they had with my former employer, AEP. The muni was paying well below market prices after the phase into competition began in Ohio in January 2000. I noticed that there was a cancellation provision that would allow AEP to notify the muni of its intent to cancel before the automatic renewal date of January 1, 2001. Upon such notification, the contract would expire at the end of the following calendar year. I suggested to the muni that AEP would probably be notifying them before the year end to cancel this 20-plus-year-old contract. The muni would then have 12 months to prepare for the inevitable increase. On cue, AEP faxed its intent to cancel on December 31, 2000. The muni began paying market prices on January 1, 2002. Let me use Leggett as my last example. Leggett operates one of the largest electric arc furnaces, EAFs, in the world at Sterling Steel Company, located behind PJM. Prior to January 1, 2007, we paid 2.9 cents per kilowatt hour at Sterling. This was a grandfathered deal we had with Commonwealth Edison. ComEd exercised its cancellation clause in the Sterling contract, as AEP had done with my muni client several years earlier. I understand why they did it, and I also understand the logical response by industrial customers and groups representing those customers to maintain the status quo. It is no wonder that customer surveys of industrial customers in regulated service areas versus industrials in competitive markets show a marked difference. As a company that maximizes profits and has a focus on shareholder return, we understand the desire to minimize every controllable expense. Now that we are paying market prices at Sterling, we are responding to the market signals behind the Northern Illinois hub of PJM. Sterling operates a 15-megawatt rolling mill, 7x24, and the 85-megawatt EAF, we call it the melt shop, that operates primarily on weekends. In 2008, earlier this year, business increased for the steel ingots we produce from the melt shop operation. And this made it necessary for us to extend the melt shop operation into the work week. Well, enter the PJM RPM. It became apparent that we had an incentive to manage around PJM's five coincident peaks. Operating the melt shop coincident with only one coincident peak hour, would cost approximately $700,000. Did we respond to this price signal? You better believe it. Conversely, had our steel operation been located only 75 miles south behind MISO, we probably would have absorbed the differences in hourly energy price and extend weekday operations without regard to system peaking conditions, potentially contributing to new peaks and or affecting the integrity of system reliability. I believe the RPM is a logical evolution toward valuing capacity. Is it perfect? No. But the absence of a capacity market translates into a subsidization between energy and capacity, creating disincentives for supply-side investment, as the two gentlemen spoke before me, and demand response participation. As an additional response to the market price signals, we have enrolled 3 megawatts in the PJM Interruptible Load for Reliability program. Given the RPM price signals for the auction periods 2009-10 and 2010 to 2011, we've also relocated a 2-megawatt standby generator from a closed facility in Arkansas to Sterling. Lastly, improvements in technology and communications provide real-time access to energy use data behind the meter and in the supply-side marketplace. Advanced metering, telecommunications, and data processing are fundamental to the competitive marketplace by producing the price transparency on a real-time basis, as well as providing the necessary coordination by the RTO for optimal grid reliability. And since I'm about out of time, I'll just say that the new energy marketplace does encourage consumer energy efficiency and conservation far beyond the one-size-fits-all model of yesteryear. And make no mistake about it, competitive electricity markets are working. I want to thank Judge Kacharis, Chairman Cawley, and the rest of the commissioners for this time to share our viewpoint.
Commissioners, our next speaker is Ms. Angie Beeler, Senior Director, Energy Regulation and Legislation for Walmart Stores Incorporated. Ms. Beeler.
Thank you. I so much appreciate the opportunity to share our views for the current and the future wholesale markets in Pennsylvania. As an energy consumer, Walmart appreciates the Commission's support for comments on wholesale markets, and Walmart also applauds the Commission's efforts to continually improve their operation. We believe there are many benefits emanating from these markets, and we'll share some of our experiences with you regarding the choice of third-party energy suppliers in Pennsylvania, environmental attributes available to customers in Pennsylvania, renewable opportunities for customers in Pennsylvania, demand response opportunities for customers in Pennsylvania and in PJM, as well as cost-effective smart grid enhancements that hopefully will enlighten your understanding from our perspective, the customer. Thank you. This market, most importantly, provides opportunity and the flexibility for customers to proactively manage their energy, especially during tough economic times, but it also provides a sound platform for competition. And Walmart's experience is that competitive markets are good for consumers for a variety of reasons. If the organized markets were not working and producing benefits, Walmart, as many other customers, would not participate in them. We have 83 supercenters, 41 discount stores, 23 Sam's Clubs, and 4 distribution centers throughout Pennsylvania. This is a lot of variety with different kinds of loads. We employ almost 53,000 associates across Pennsylvania. We support 165,000 supplier jobs across Pennsylvania. We're also helping with the Greening State Capitals program here in Pennsylvania with recommendations to save energy, lower electricity costs, and reduce GHG emissions for your state capital here. Yesterday, we're also working with teachers in Philadelphia to share and help them buy classroom supplies. Competitive markets give Walmart more flexibility in managing our energy, which in turn enables us to deliver greater value to our customer, in effect saving them money so they can live better. These structures provide Walmart the opportunity to earn these savings by assuming the risk for managing its own energy supply needs. It needs to be stressed that competitive electric markets do not guarantee Walmart any cost savings, as it should any in competitive markets. They simply offer Walmart the opportunity to gain or lose various benefits by becoming responsible and accountable for our energy supply. But however, we do participate in 14 states across the U.S. in competitive markets, and 19 for gas. There have been rate freezes since the 1990s in Pennsylvania, but recently Duquesne and Penn Power, two of the major five utilities, rate caps have expired. We are experiencing significant savings and mitigation to our energy costs in these two markets alone, with only 14 locations. In November also, Walmart became its own self-supplier in Texas and supply 350 stores of our own throughout Texas in that competitive market. Recently, we also decided to do the same thing in the UK for over 350 locations. These are some of the great things that we want to tell you that we like about the wholesale markets of Pennsylvania in particular. Number one, we think you've done a great job with white certificates. These allow consumers across Pennsylvania to really retain some of the benefits that are coming from their energy efficiency projects and actions across the state of Pennsylvania. We don't see enough of these environmental attributes being transmitted to customers, and we are very, very pleased to see that. So you're doing a terrific job on that. Number two, demand response is a tier two renewable across Pennsylvania. This is an awesome, another thing that you can do to really incent consumers to do their best to help the market and the grid across Pennsylvania. Demand response in the organized market. This is also great. Demand response and advanced metering. There is some of the most successful and effective demand response programs that really incent customer conservation throughout the PJM wholesale market. They pay both for energy and capacity reductions. These ISOs give ratepayers additional choice and flexibility for smart grid enhancements such as advanced meters that we've installed all across Pennsylvania, some of our most technical advanced meters. Pennsylvania is a part of PJM, and there are customer benefits associated with ISOs that we have experienced. Independent entity, fair access to the transmission system, increased economic efficiency from eliminating pancake transmission costs, providing better scheduling of transmission lines, improving congestion, coordinating system expansion, improving regional reliability, increased economic dispatch of generation sources, coordinate maintenance schedules of generation and transmission, and increase competitive markets. We understand that markets such as these do come with cost, but as long as the costs are reasonable and prudent, these benefits also provide cost savings to ratepayers in the process. We know this because we also have an aspirational goal of 100% renewable energy that our CEO laid out for us in 2005. We are aggressively looking at renewable projects across the U.S., and in these ISOs and RTOs, we are being able to look at those deals from a financial side and shave pennies also off of those transactions as we run the numbers. Walmart has had a successful competitive experience as two of the five major utility rate caps have expired. Walmart has invested our own advanced meters with our fastest data interval times across PA now. Other positive factors we enjoy in the competitive current wholesale markets are pricing options with flexibility. We can just about ask for any kind of rate that would fit our different load types that we need. Also, we hear a lot of needing long-term contracts with reliable fixed pricing for additional other customers. This can be had. I think all that needs to be done is ask those competitive suppliers. They're very receptive to us to help fit pricing structures. They could do the same for those other customers that are asking for long-term power. Exceptional customer service. Where we do have competitive markets, It seems that we are the suppliers that compete for our business, as well as us benchmarking against polar rates for the utilities. The suppliers are very willing to share our data from one person to the other when we need to switch suppliers. We get as many bids from different suppliers as we can because competition is what it's all about. However, in the regulated market, sometimes we're charged per account for our data that is our own data. And so this sometimes is a barrier to competitive markets. In competitive markets, developers of new generation, not the ratepayers, bear the development and financing cost. Construction work in progress, we're involved in about 30 or 35 rate proceedings across the U.S. right now. And we're seeing construction work in progress, something that used to be only required from long-standing regulatory precedent, only awarded when the utility is about to go in bankruptcy. However, we're seeing more and more of these cost increases across the country, along with expense programs for energy efficiency programs, demand response programs, decoupling. But we don't see a lot of this in the competitive markets. So we can do a lot more on our own with flexibility and innovation in these markets. For example, just in Florida recently, for our facilities alone, we're going to spend $1.7 million just for our cost with Progress and $1.4 million for CWIP costs with FBL. That's a lot of money, and we need to manage those costs.
1 minute.
Renewables, as I said earlier, it's easier to get onto the grid, make investments in renewable power, negotiate your pricing. Decoupling, we don't see a lot of decoupling in competitive markets. Creativity, environmental attributes trickle down when earned with DR, energy efficiency and renewables in competitive markets. We can allow aggregation to grow our rates and our facilities. There are no huge deferral that hits on fuel adjustments. When you get a price for a certain amount of time for your rates, that's your rates, and you don't face huge increases at a later date for fuel. Anyway, basically, we enjoy many, many successes with competitive markets. As Steve mentioned, there's no perfect model, but we appreciate the efforts that you're making. Consumers are seeing benefits, and we appreciate the flexibility to manage our energy cost, and try to make a difference with environmental and do the best things for our customers to manage our energy costs. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Commissioners, we are slightly behind schedule, and this is just past the time you had wanted to take a break. I don't know whether you want to continue with your questioning at this point. I would recommend that we take the break and shorten it to 10 minutes.
Now, how could we refuse a recommendation like that? Okay, 10 minutes, and then we'll ask some questions.
Thank you.